Hey, what's up? John Doherty here for Radio Tacoma's Climate Talk. The tentacles of climate change are long and often difficult to anticipate until they show up. One of the things we do know, and that it's not a surprise, is that the Sound, along with much of the world's oceans, is getting more acidic. What we didn't know was that acidification was going to directly impact our shellfish industry in surprising ways, ways that it took a lot of effort and smart people to figure out. Today we're talking with Bill Dewey. He's the Director of Public Affairs at Taylor Shellfish. Safe to say that Taylor Shellfish is a household name around the Sound, and it's an iconic part of our state economy that's been around for over 100 years. So let's listen in as Bill Dewey talks with me about this amazing company and how it's responding to a changing climate and environment. Bill Dewey, welcome to Climate Talk.
Thanks, John. Appreciate the invite.
Bill's Director of Public Affairs at Taylor Shellfish. So I'm going to start off with some full disclosure here, and that is I'm a big fan of Taylor Shellfish, and I really, what's not to love? Kind of the hometown team, an admired business on the Sound producing one of my favorite foods, shellfish. In fact, a couple of weeks ago, I stumbled into the Taylor restaurant up near Pioneer Square and had oysters for the starter, and I had oysters for the main dish, and it was fabulous. So we're here to talk about climate and environment, not about the delights of eating shellfish. So let's start off, Bill, by giving us some background on Taylor Shellfish. How long you've been around? What do you do? Why do you do it? And all of that.
Sure. Yeah. So the Taylor family started farming shellfish in southern Puget Sound in the Sheldon area back in 1890. So I work for the fourth generation, and the fifth generation, all of their kids are starting to take over the helm there at the company. We affectionately refer to them as G5. I think we've got seven of the kids there, the cousins all stepping into different management roles, and it's been a really wonderful transition. The kids are doing a great job. So, but we, the company's expanded in recent years. Over the last 30 years, we built a hatchery back in 1989 up in the Hood Canal, initially to improve our supply of oyster seed, but then we learned quickly that we could also produce manila clam seed and mussel seed and eventually geoduck seed. So the hatchery's really helped us diversify what we farm and keep our grounds as productive as possible. So lots of different species. We have about 14,000 acres of tidelands that we own or lease. All of the inlets in southern Puget Sound, with the exception of Bud Inlet, I think we've got shellfish going in all of them, and Hood Canal, and then in northern Puget Sound in Samish Bay, we've got a couple thousand acre farm there in Samish. And then out on the coast in southwest Washington, we've got a 6,000 acre farm there in Willapa Bay, where we do clams and oysters. And then we have a hatchery on the Hood Canal in Daybob Bay, another hatchery nursery operation in Kona, Hawaii, and a big nursery operation in Northern California in Humboldt Bay that supplies seed to all of our farms. And then we also sell seed to growers all up and down the coast, and also export seed out of the country as well. And then just to finish off, about 20 years ago, we started investing in farms in British Columbia. There was opportunities up there with a number of farms for sale, and we took advantage of that. So we now have a number of farms in BC as well. So pretty diverse operation, still very much family owned and run. Like I said, all the family members are actively working every day on the farms and running the farms. And I think we do that now. We're just over 500 employees between all our different operations here in Washington State. And then I forgot to mention, you already did, of course, the restaurants there. We've got three oyster bars in Seattle. And then the processing facility at our Samish Bay farm has been converted into a shellfish market and oyster bar as well, which is one of our more popular spots there.
So a very big presence in the Pacific Northwest, and as you say, up into British Columbia now, which I was not aware of, and I'm going to ask you a question about that here in a minute. But just for an understanding of the scope of Taylor, in terms of dollars, annual sales or something like that?
Yeah, so So volume, you know, we do between 4 and 5 million pounds of Manila clams a year, every year. And we do about 1.5 million pounds of mussels, between 800,000 and 1 million pounds of gooey duck, and somewhere around 40 to 50 million oysters a year. Our sales, I think our gross sales this year are somewhere in the neighborhood of $70 million. So
quite a presence.
Yeah.
So I've heard that Taylor ships shellfish as far away as to the East Coast. Is there anything to that?
Oh, we ship it all over the country and all over the world. We and definitely all the major cities around the United States we sell to. And then, of course, we have our online retail store. And through that, we sell all over the country through that as well. And we export. Somewhere in the neighborhood of a third of our products get exported, mostly to Asian countries, although the European Union has reopened for U.S. shellfish here recently, and so we're starting to ship some over to Europe as well.
So you've mentioned gooey ducks a couple of times. I'm a graduate of the Evergreen State College. I don't know if you know that the mascot of the Evergreen State College is the gooey duck.
Yeah, Speedy there. Yeah, absolutely.
So I'm guessing that the market for gooey duck is more in Asia than in the United States. Is that correct?
Well, it's a lot of it is with the Asian culture. The majority of them are eaten in hot pots. It's a popular dish in the cooler fall months and winter months. And so a lot of them are exported to China and Hong Kong. We sell a lot of ours domestically, but to Asian markets domestically as well as exports. So we're kind of divided there between selling here in the United States and overseas as well.
Okay, so I wanted to ask you about British Columbia. So how regulatorily, relationships with government, how have you found that transition into British Columbia, which probably has kind of a different environment, business-wise, environmentally, and so on?
Yeah, I'm not actively involved as I am here with all of our laws and regulations. They don't have me working so much in British Columbia, but it's turned out to be a really good decision for the company. It's worked out well. It's just as difficult to get farms permitted up there as it is here. The fortune we had is that we were purchasing farms that were already permitted and just they weren't being actively farmed, you know, so we had leases, we had tenures, we had all the permits and stuff. So we just had to bring shellfish and gear to the party and we were off and running, which was a great advantage. And then the BC government and the federal government in Canada are really supportive of aquaculture, shellfish aquaculture in particular. You know, salmon farming has been controversial there as it has been here, but the shellfish farming they've been really supportive of and it's been a good experience for us.
Yeah, well, I'm glad to hear of that good experience up there in BC. I mean, I love BC. I've been a boater for decades and I've spent many summers in the waters up in British Columbia. And of course, every once in a while skirting around some aquaculture somewhere. So I'm glad that's working out. And as I said, I love British Columbia. What's not what to love?
And so, in BC, we do business up there as Fannie Bay Oyster Company. So we purchased Fannie Bay years ago. They're the largest producer there in BC. So we just kept their brand since it was recognized and actually have another oyster bar in downtown Vancouver under the Fannie Bay name.
Oh, okay. Well, good. Next time I'm up there, I'll look for that. So we're here to talk mostly about the climate and environment and so on. So let's just start off. You mentioned, you know, salmon being a little controversial and, of course, environmental impacts, impacts on other species and so on as a part of that controversial approach. So what about shellfish? Are there environmentally challenging issues with raising shellfish in a, let's say, a responsible way?
You know, shellfish, I mean, just by any kind of food production, you're going to have some sort of an impact. And, right. And you know, shellfish, at least in my opinion, I've been doing it for 40 years now and walk on our beds every day. I have a shellfish farm of my own up in Skagit County as well. And, You know, I think it's cool because you grow shellfish, and it's not like a terrestrial farm. You go plow the field and eliminate all the weeds and take everything out. We go out and we plant our shellfish, and everything that lives out there lives on and in our crops. And in a lot of cases, our crops are providing habitat and refuge and food for a variety of predators and foraging opportunities. So, you know, it's not without its challenges. We're going to have some impacts when we're out there just, you know, walking around in that environment. And with the harvesting, you know, there's disruptions, but it's a dynamic environment. The critters that have evolved to live there are used to being disturbed all the time by storms mm-hmm. and currents and tides. So they're used to repopulating areas quickly when they've been disturbed. And that's our observation is, you know, you'll have a little disruption with your farming activities and pretty quickly it's all recovered and things are back and healthy again. And so, probably, you know, one of our most challenging issues is as the shorelines have developed, particularly around southern Puget Sound, it's more an issue of user conflict, you know, where people aren't used to seeing a working waterfront. They move in here from California or wherever outside the area. They don't have appreciation for the fact that this is an industry that's been here for a century and the jobs and so on that it provides and how it's part of our local culture. And as such, you know, we run into people that maybe don't want to see it happening out in front of their houses. So.
Yeah, well, that's reminiscent of not in my backyard, right? That we want to have an economy and an industry and jobs and all of that, but everybody else says, well, do it some other place, not here.
Yeah, but, you know, I mean, the having critics out there is healthy. You know, because sometimes they'll come to us with legitimate concerns that we maybe haven't recognized, we've overlooked. And so we're happy to listen and make corrections, adjust our practices. And we also participate in a lot of studies to ensure that we're, you know, current on the science and doing the best we can by the environment. And we've gotten a lot of recognition for that. We also maintain a third-party certification, so it's not just us saying that we're out there doing it right. There's a third-party certifier out of Portland called the Food Alliance, and they developed mm-hmm. bivalve standards for shellfish farming, and we've maintained for a number of years now, we've maintained certification by them, so we have a third-party auditor that comes in and checks the farms. And then, you know, the products that we raise, the clams, mussels, and oysters we raise are considered best choices by the Monterey Bay Aquarium Seafood Watch Program, mm-hmm. which is another thing that people look closely at. And here just recently, we were recognized by Seafood Source, which is one of the trade publications, as one of the top 25 seafood companies in North America, leading in its sustainability and conservation practices. So,
yeah, great credentials there. You make a point that I think is really important, and that is human activity results in impacts of one kind or the other. And our goal is we cannot eliminate those impacts, but our goal is to limit them and manage them in a responsible kind of way, which especially with third party auditing, it sounds like Taylor's got that one figured out. So let me ask you how important is it to Taylor Shellfish that the sound, and you operate in other places too, as well as Puget Sound, how important is the environmental health of the waters where you operate to a successful operation?
It's totally critical. I mean, that's been the bulk of my work. Taylor's created my position over 30 years ago, and the main purpose of it at the time was to try to ensure that the laws and regulations in place to protect our environment were adequate and they were being enforced so that we had clean waters and healthy environment to grow our shellfish. And that's where I spent a lot of my time still today is, you know, working on on-site sewage regulations, stormwater regulations, agricultural runoff issues, you know, working with the conservation districts and the various county departments and state departments that oversee all that.
Yeah, the list that you make there sort of sounds like the wanted list for the big offenders, agricultural runoff, sewers, shoreline construction and those kind of things. So what would you say, we're going to talk about acidity here in a second, but those ones that you're talking about there, has it become more of a challenge dealing with those kinds of problems over the last 10, 20, 30 years?
Well, it's definitely more of a challenge, you know, as we see the growth around Puget Sound. Everyone wants to live on the water, of course, you know, and there's going to be impacts from that. But to be perfectly honest, we've been very fortunate to have the Puget Sound Partnership and their action agenda to restore the Puget Sound. They've got three strategic initiatives the Puget Sound Partnership does. One is stormwater, addressing stormwater. The other is habitat for salmon, of course. And the third is shellfish. Mm-hmm. You know, so they've got a shellfish strategic initiative, and we've been very fortunate with our members of Congress, with Senator Murray and Congressman Kilmer, and Marilyn Strickland, Congressman Strickland, the three of them have worked really hard to secure funding to implement that action agenda. The Shellfish Strategic Initiative, they just announced $5.5 million going out in grants to the various counties for pollution identification and correction programs and identifying these sources of pollution that are impacting the growing areas and fixing them. So because of that, we have been on a very positive trend, gaining even with all of the growth, we've been gaining positively upgraded areas as opposed to downgraded. You know, they maintain a balance of monitoring areas that are approved for shellfish harvest or restricted for shellfish harvest. And it's been a net gain for many years until the last two. We've slipped a little bit. So we're a little concerned about that. But all in all, I think it's been good. We're holding our ground. We're gaining a little bit. And we're thankful for all the attention and funding that's been available to work on it.
Yeah, so that's good to hear. And it's actually different from what I expected you were going to say. And it does point out that we can do operations of various kinds. And with effort, we can minimize our impact on the environment. In fact, it sounds like, as you say, things have been improving in that regard a little bit. So kudos to you and the representatives that you mentioned who have been a part of that.
Another program we have that's really been helpful is that we four or five times a year, I think it's five times a year now, we do seed sales, retail seed sales to people that own waterfront property that want to garden shellfish in front of their house. And they can order seed from us and come pick it up on a low tide Saturday. And, you know, we'll coach them on what they need to do with it. And then, you know, when we're selling them the seed, we can say, hey, by the way, you know, when you're ready to harvest this stuff and eat it, you might want to check on your septic system. You know, you might want to think about picking up after the dog or what you're putting on your lawn. You know, it's really helped educate waterfront owners about the importance of protecting that water quality.
Yeah, so I've got some familiarity with that. I lived on the Kitsap Peninsula, South Kitsap, and a lot of people there had shellfish out, and of course there was always the buzz about when it's time to go over to Taylor's and pick up
to get the seed. The seed sales have been, it's all been word of mouth. We haven't done any advertising on it, but boy, it's become very popular. People really enjoy doing it. It's great.
Sure. So let's talk about acidity a little bit. A brief background that we've, as a species, we've been pumping a lot of carbon dioxide out in the atmosphere. Big chunk of that has gone into the ocean, where it creates carbonic acid. And so the overall acidity of the ocean has been increasing over the years. And Puget Sound, as you probably know, is somewhat of a poster child for acidification from a number of reasons, which we won't go into here. But I'll just ask, so in what way, if any, has acidification of this water in the sound been impacting Taylor's operations?
Yeah, well, not just Taylor's, but a number of people in the industry here. Back in 2007, 2008, we started to experience some major losses in our hatchery. We had a real challenge producing oyster larvae in particular. And at the same time, good friends of ours with a major hatchery on the Oregon coast, also big suppliers to the industry, were experiencing the same problems. Mm-hmm. And it took a collaboration of industry scientists, university scientists, and NOAA scientists to kind of sort through what was causing the problem. And of course, it came to light that it was, in fact, this acidification of the ocean. And what happens, this chemical reaction, when CO2 is absorbed by seawater, is it forms carbonic acid, but it also reduces the number number of carbonate ions that are in the water, which are the building blocks of the shells of the animals that we raise.
Gotcha.
And so we were having episodes in our hatchery where we'd have these upwelling events off the coast or in the Hood Canal, and that bad water would come into the hatchery and there wouldn't be enough carbonate ions to build their shells. These tiny little oyster larvae are using a form of calcium carbonate at that stage of their life that's really vulnerable, and it would dissolve faster than they could form it, and their shells would come out. They'd be all deformed, and they wouldn't, they'd run out of energy after the egg is fertilized. They've got about 24 hours to form a shell and build this little feeding organ and swimming organ that they motate with and feed with, all with energy that's stored within that egg. Well, if there's not enough carbonate ions in the water, they struggle to build that shell and they run out of energy before they build the feeding organ and then die. So we've worked through that, thankfully, with, you know, this great research that helped us figure this story out. We now have sophisticated monitoring, seawater chemistry monitoring equipment in the hatchery and water treatment systems that add sodium carbonate to the water to boost the carbonate ions up in the water so the shellfish, the larvae, can build their shells again. So, but there was a 2 or 3 year period there where we had a real oyster seed crisis on the West Coast because the major producers didn't have seed to sell. There's some areas where the industry would collect natural recruitment, natural larvae set, and those were failing at the same time. So, you know, that got the attention of our politicians. Governor Gregoire at the time formed the Ocean Acidification Blue Ribbon Panel, and we got support from the federal government and helped us work through that. And it continues today that Blue Ribbon Panel and the plan that they came up with for the state to respond to ocean acidification has in fact become a model that's being used throughout the world now. We were the first state in the world, first government in the world to come up with a response plan for ocean acidification, and it served as a great model.
Yeah, so quite a detective story there. It must have been a real head scratcher when it first started showing up.
It definitely was. It was a very sobering day when Dr. Feely, Richard Feely at the, with NOAA there in Seattle, is one of the leading world experts on ocean acidification. And in 2008, he came to our Shellfish Growers Conference and delivered the sobering news. And it was, what was almost more sobering was, you know, here's what I think is killing your baby oysters. But oh, by the way, you know, even if you're able to convince the world to stop burning fossil fuels, it's going to get worse for you for the next 30 to 50 years because of what's already absorbed in the Pacific Ocean and coming your way.
Yeah.
So it was a really sobering message, and it's caused us as an industry to focus on, okay, how do we adapt and mitigate, because it's going to get worse before it gets better. You know, that's been our focus, is looking at, you know, can we breed oysters that can tolerate these conditions better? Can we change to different species that are more tolerant because they're not all affected the same? Can we find areas that are either a natural refuge, you know, for example, Samish Bay or Willapa Bay, where we have extensive eelgrass beds? That eelgrass is sucking up the CO2 and naturally mitigating those water chemistry problems. Or can we co-culture seaweed next to our shellfish farms and do the same thing? You know, so those are all things that the industry is looking at for our future.
Yeah. So I want to check and see if I understand something correctly. So you've done these adaptive measures to ensure that the larvae survive long enough to be on their own. So is that in an artificial environment, or is it in an artificial environment?
It is. That's in our hatchery in Daybob Bay. And so, you know, there it's a closed, well, not a closed system, but we're, you know, it's in tanks in the hatchery. We're pumping water from Daybob Bay, but it's not a huge volume. It's like 400 gallons a minute. And it's easy for us to monitor that and alter the chemistry of that small volume of water. We can't do that on our farms and in our nurseries out in the bay. So that's why we're looking for these natural solutions once we're out on the farms.
Yeah. So put a little differently then, let's say wild shellfish that are subject to this acidic water, they're probably in trouble. Is that right?
They're probably in trouble. We've tried to, you know, interestingly, we've pointed this out to the Department of Natural Resources, who manage the geoduck resources, the wild geoduck resources in the state. So growing geoduck seed in our hatchery, that was a bottleneck in growing that industry. We were unsuccessful trying to figure, crack that nut and produce our Goiduck seed, because the shells would be so thin that in the nursery systems, as they rubbed on each other, they would erode holes in their shells and get bacterial infections, or erode in the sand that they're buried in. And once we started treating the seawater in the hatchery and adding carbonate ions to it, all of a sudden these Goiduck shells got super hard, and no longer were they eroding holes in each other, and we were able to produce Goiduck seeds successfully. Well, to me, that should be an alarm for DNR, because the worst, the most acidic waters in Puget Sound are at depths where these Goiduck beds are. They're all down deep, and that's where some of your most acidic water is. And if they're observing the same thing in the wild that we are in our hatchery, and those shells are getting thinner and thinner and eroding away, it could be affecting the wild population.
Yeah, sobering, of course. One quick thing. You mentioned Kona a little earlier. Now, this is comes under the heading of my own folk wisdom. Did you guys start operating in Kona because of concerns about acidification in the sound here?
We did not. We were there probably 20 years before that problem.
I see. Okay.
There's another company that came over there because they couldn't get seed here. And they got a lot of media attention. It's Goose Point Oyster Company. They built a hatchery over in Hilo, and that got a lot of international media attention. So we're often mistaken for that. But okay. we'd actually gone to Kona about 20 years before, because if you're trying to grow baby oysters and clams in nurseries here in Washington in the wintertime, it's difficult. There's no artificial food for these guys. So you got to grow live marine plankton to feed them. Mm-hmm. And we do that in greenhouses, right? And so we're using a lot of electricity for lights. And then if we're successful at growing that algae in the middle of the winter, the water we're pumping in is cold. So we've got to use heat. You know, we've got to use propane to heat that water up to get the metabolism of the animals up so they'll eat the food that we're growing for them. And it's just really expensive and not very successful. And so somebody really smart in the company thought, you know, these things are tiny. At that stage of their life, you can put 20 million of them in a six-pack beer cooler with a gel ice pack and fly them anywhere in the world. Let's go someplace warm and sunny where it's easier to do this. And there was an aquaculture park there in Kona. So off we went with our larvae, and it took us a while to figure it out, but we got a system set up there, and it was wonderful that we had it, because when the production failed in Debaw Bay at our hatchery here in Washington, we had that facility over there, and we could boost our larvae production over there to offset losses we were experiencing here.
Yep, cool. Well, now I understand more of the details of that Kona story. And I guess I feel like apologizing a little bit for kind of laughing while you were talking. I was just laughing about the incredible complexity of what you're talking about. I mean, you know, as a guy who's thrown some bags out into the water in front of my house, that was pretty simple. You know, throw it out there and pretty soon you got some oysters to eat. But so many things in this world are far more complicated than they appear on the surface.
And, well, I appreciate the opportunity to tell the story, because a lot of people just assume that we go out on the beach and pick these things up and charge a whole bunch of money for them and have no idea what goes into producing them. With our, you know, the hatchery facilities are incredible, and then nurseries, because when these things leave the hatchery, they're only a millimeter or two in size, so still too small to go to the farm.
Yeah.
So then we have to get them into nursery systems to get them up to, depending on the species, maybe the size of your pinky or thumbnail, when you can actually move them to the farm and hope you get some level of survival when you put them out in the wild. And all that takes just a lot of infrastructure and planning and coordination to do.
And experience for 100 years.
Yeah, that helps.
So it sounds a little bit like raising babies in a way. You know, it's like a lot of effort for an outcome that's not guaranteed ever. So that's about, we've talked about acidification, and I have no idea what the answer to this is. Is temperature in the Puget Sound? Now, you've made a couple of allusions to it, but I mean, the Sound has always been a pretty cold body of water. Is temperature change in the Sound an issue at all that Taylor's concerned about?
You know, I mean, not that we've seen directly on our farms, but I mean, one of our big challenges is a naturally occurring bacteria that's present in warm summer months. It's called Vibrio parahemolyticus. It's a real mouthful, but it's a dominant in warmer waters. And so as the Puget Sound warms up and we see warmer temperatures, it becomes more of a problem for us. And it, if it's in the oysters, when we sell them for raw consumption, it will give people gastroenteritis. And so it's a big public health concern. In fact, I'm heading off to a conference in a couple of days, the Interstate Shellfish Sanitation Conference, and Vibrio is one of the biggest issues they deal with nationally. It's a problem all around the country. So, you know, warming waters, that becomes an issue. We actually feel like we've come up with a pretty good solution for that here. Just recently, the company has invested a tremendous amount of money to build a huge closed recirculating refrigerated seawater system for holding all of our oysters that are going for raw consumption. And we hold them in there, and then we've been able to do the monitoring and track these levels of Vibrio, so we can test the Vibrio level when it comes off the beach and then monitor as it drops down to safe levels in the oysters before we sell the oysters. So it's been a good solution, because prior to that, the only methods that are approved to reduce the Vibrio by the Food and Drug Administration all result in a dead oyster, which is not what you want to sell in your oyster bars. So.
Yeah, right, exactly. Well, once again, things more complicated in the detail than they appear on the surface of it. So just clear up one thing for me. So you mentioned, of course, the warmer waters in the summer, and historically, Puget Sound waters have always been warmer in the summer. So is there any change in that pattern?
Well, it's not significant enough that we've probably noticed it.
Yeah.
You know, Vibrio has been an issue for us for years, and we've grappled with how to deal with it. The state's got put a lot of time into rule development to make sure products being handled to minimize the risk and so on with refrigeration, et cetera. But, you know, and then, of course, we had the heat bomb here a couple of years ago, which got everybody's attention. There was a lot of shellfish mortality in the news there. And that was just kind of a unique situation. I mean, obviously, that was hot weather like we've never, ever experienced in history. But it just happened to overlap an extreme low tide. One of the most extreme low tides that we've had in a decade. And so the shellfish were out there and exposed for a prolonged period of time at 108 degrees, and they cooked on the beach. And, you know, hopefully we don't repeat that scenario again. You know, I mean, it was just like the perfect storm, so to speak.
Yeah. So the perfect storm, so it's the intersection of two things that by themselves are probably not a problem, but when they intersect, there's a problem. And of course,
exactly.
All you got to do is do enough iterations of something. And if there's a possibility of that, it's going to happen.
Yeah. And it happens to us in the winter too. We can get those extreme low tides in the winter with a freezing event and freeze our shellfish too. This is interesting to me, maybe not to you or your listeners, but you know, I've worked 40 years on the tides, so I pay attention to the tides.
Yeah.
And my personal farm in Samish Bay is actually down pretty deep, so I need really good tides to work it. And I noticed after I'd been working it for a few years that those big low tides started to disappear, and I didn't understand why. You know, when I first started working my farm, I had 3-foot minus tides, and then pretty quick there were just 2-foot minuses. There wasn't 3-foot minus tides. And that's why I'm talking to some oceanographers and learned about this 18.6-year tidal cycle.
Oh.
I can't explain it. It's due to the moon wobble. Yeah. But over that 18.6-year period, the amplitude of the tide will change by as much as a half a meter. So we're at that point right now in the 18.6-year cycle where we're having those big extreme low tides and high tides. So remember the King Tide event back in December?
Right.
We had an extreme high, and then we had a low pressure system on top of that, which let the tide come up even higher and caused all of that shoreline, the coastal flooding. But part of that was related to that 18.6-year cycle and where we're at in it that made it worse. And that was why the heat dome caused those mortalities, because we're having the extreme lows more so than we had in a whole decade.
Yeah. Well, as a boater, I'm very interested in tides as well, especially up in British Columbia when I'm going through a lot of those channels where there are some extreme currents from time to time. But I also love the tides. I mean, they're really a big part of what makes the Puget Sound what it is.
And, absolutely.
You know, I spend a little bit of time with relatives down in Florida, and I kind of looked down my nose at them with those little itsy bitsy ducks.
Yeah, it's like being on a lake compared to Puget Sound. Right.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we're close to the end here, Bill. I've learned a lot from talking to you. So if summarize, if you can, what Taylor's expectation is about the environmental future, including climate change and population growth and so on and so forth. How is Taylor feeling about the future?
You know, I'm always amazed that the Taylor family are very positive and very optimistic. You know, over the years of the, you know, the generations here that have been farming, they've faced a lot of adversity, you know, from back in the pulp mill era and effluent from the pulp mills wiping out oysters, and then, you know, ocean acidification, and, you know, all these different things that get thrown at us. And they just endure, you know, they keep a positive attitude and figure out, okay, how do we adapt? How do we come out of this? You know, the pandemic, COVID, you know, here we thought we'd, one of the things the company's done that I credit them for that keeps us secure for the future is diversify. Mm-hmm. So we're diverse in geographies with all of our different locations. So if we have a pollution event or an oil spill or a red tide event, you know, and closes down shellfish growing areas, we can always supply the market because we have so many different growing areas. We're diverse in species. So if you got a disease outbreak or you got a market collapse on a certain species, we've got multiple species that we farm to keep the business going. And then we have diverse markets. You know, we sell all over the country and all over the world. So occasionally China will get a hiccup and they'll shut the border down to U.S. shellfish, and we might lose that market for a couple of months. But because we have all the domestic markets, it makes us. So anyhow, it's not a short answer to your question, but you know, they're positive on the future, positive on the environment. We keep working on those issues. You know, we're a founding member of what's called the Shellfish Growers Climate Coalition. That, you know, we were one of the original seven companies to form it. We've now got 250 plus members all around the country of shellfish growers that are using the stories about how changing ocean chemistry or climate change is impacting their business to go talk to policymakers in Washington, D.C. and in their states and to the public, share their stories to try to influence our energy policies going forward.
Well, that's really a great way of summarizing things. And I got to say that the approach that Taylor has that you just sketched out for us is really a model for all of us, that, you know, there is a future. It's easy to get gloom and doomy, but with care and effort and energy and creativity over time, we can create a good future, not only for Taylor Shellfish, but for all of us.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, it's easy to, like you say, to get down about it, but everybody contributes a little bit and it makes a difference, and you know, we can improve things all together.
Okay, well, with that, we're going to call it a day. Bill Dewey, Director of Public Affairs at Taylor Shellfish, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, John. It's been a pleasure.
Many thanks to Bill Dewey for his close-up and personal view of Taylor Shellfish and how it's been impacted by a changing climate and environment, and what they're doing and continue to do to adapt. There's also a further lesson in this story, and that is we cannot escape the ever-worsening consequences of our man-made climate change. And knowing that, it's up to us to do what we can, individually and collectively, to minimize the damage. You can contact me at john@ccltacoma.org for comments on this program or to make suggestions for future programs. This program, along with all other locally produced Radio Tacoma programs, can be found on the KTAH website under programming. In the meantime, always live like the mountain is out, and take care now.